So tonight we are finishing up the Song of Solomon, and I just want to you guys to give James a hand because he handled two of the most erotic passages. And when we broke it up, I didn't intentionally say, James, you get to talk about all those things, but apparently he did get to talk about all those things, and he did a really good job. So I give him a hand. I think he did a really good job. My passage tonight's not so spicy, so I'm sorry if you came for spice. There's not going to be any spice. But let me give you a review and tell you where we're going and stuff like that. We are finishing up the Song of Solomon. And next week, we are going to start a 37-week series on the Gospel of Mark. So we will be in the Gospel of Mark until February of next year. We'll take some breaks for our membership stuff and stuff like that. But we're going to go through the Gospel of Mark. It should be a lot of fun. If you don't know what a gospel is, it is it's Jesus' story. You can open the New Testament. There are four of them. But anyway, Song of Solomon. The reason that we've been addressing the Song of Solomon is pretty simple. If I look at you just every so often, it's just because you're the only three people sitting over there. So most of the time, I'm just going to stand over here and look at these people, but occasionally, I'll look over there. But we've been doing the Song of Solomon simply because, as I said when we opened this up, our culture, even if we're not extreme participants in it, our culture has got sex and relationships messed up, and we've all drank from the toilet of our culture. And so we've all been influenced by the value systems, we've been influenced by, we've just been influenced by a lot of garbage. And so one of the things that the church over history has been kind of silent on is relationships and sexuality. Now, more recently, the church is trying to say something, and we're joining that voice as a community to say, hey, God actually has a plan, he has a way of doing things, and he has some of the best poetry and some of the most ancient poetry about relationships and sex. So we delved into Song of Solomon, and basically what we've watched is this woman and this man in their engagement, and then from their engagement, we kind of have watched this stretched out liturgy of the wedding, and we've kind of walked through the wedding. And what we're going to enter into is these two, husband and wife, re-entering into life together back in their little town. Because Hebrew stories start out in the beginning and they end in the beginning. It's a new beginning. So that's what we're going to address. Now, one of the reasons my wife brought this up, and I want to give her credit, because you need to kind of understand why Song of Solomon is put together and is in the Bible. And she kind of explained it to me, and it made a lot of sense. So I thought I'd give it to you. The culture, first off, Solomon probably didn't write all of these poems. He probably gathered them, and there's a reason that he gathered them. All the cultures around the Hebrews, where their entire religious construct is built around sexuality and temple prostitution, and all of their holidays are built around sexuality and child sacrifice and all that. And then you have this little Hebrew community whose value is family and children, and doesn't follows the Old Testament law and doesn't have a lot to say about sexuality and doesn't have a lot to say to counter the messages. And so I think what Solomon did was collect these and edit them and put them together as a way for God to say in his scripture, here's what I believe, here's what the way I created things to be. And this is the way it should be, and it's a contrast to the rest of the culture. Because what it's saying is, all of these great things, all this eroticism, all this kind of stuff fits in marriage and should be in marriage. So we follow this woman along, and so we're going to start in chapter 8. There are Bibles all around, so you can grab a Bible. Chapter 8, verse 5. And I'm going to throw a little loop here. I don't have slides or anything. I'm going to actually use the New King James. You all have the NIV, but I really like the way the New King James kind of wrote this out, so interpreted it, translated it. So, We're going to start verse 5. Goes like this. Who is coming up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? They've had the wedding. They've taken off. They've gone on their honeymoon. And their little town is kind of a buzz. When are they coming back? And so the friends are all sort of watching for them. And here she comes. And so the friends are like, oh, here, who is that? Here they come. They're kind of, every morning they get up and they look out into the desert to see if they're coming. And they're headed in to the town. Now, let me just say this about marriage. Marriage changes your identity. When you get married, you become a different person. If you go look at Genesis chapter 2, I think verse 20, basically what God says is that once Adam sees Eve and gets all excited, he says, for this reason, a man will leave his mother and father and cleave to his wife, or will join his wife, and they'll become one. They become a new identity. And if you, the way it's said in the Hebrew is, it's kind of like the son and the father are one bone, and then the bone is broken and then refused to the wife, the woman who's broken off from her family. So they form a new family unit. And I can tell you that that was my experience, like after day one. I remember we got married and the next day we had to go to my in-laws' house and open all these presents and write down who gave what gift because, you know, we're going to spend the next 3 years thanking everybody. And by the time they got the thank you note, they're going to be like, did I really give them that? Gosh, I don't remember that. But I remember sitting there and my family's there and everybody's opening presents and I'm like, this is weird. I don't know these people. Like, I felt like in some strange way, like I knew them, but they didn't know me. Like something had happened to me overnight. Marriage changes your identity. It changes who you are. One of the things that we've been talking about in the Song of Solomon is that not only are we looking at Song of Solomon in relationships, but we're also looking at it and saying, okay, the woman in Song of Solomon represents the church, and the man represents Jesus, and we can learn something about how we interact with God and how God interacts with us, right? Well, if you've met Jesus, your identity changes, right? Everybody who's met Jesus, your identity changes. And it continues to change. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but the more you walk with Jesus, the more, in some ways, your relationships with other people get awkward as Jesus changes you. And I would say, the first thing I would suggest to you as you think about your relationship with Jesus tonight and identity change is, are people awkward around me? Am I is Jesus in a consistent changing of me so that people are awkward and uncomfortable and kind of trying to figure out how to relate because I'm changing for the good, for the better? Like there's things that are different about me? Because if they aren't, then I would suggest that you consider your relationship with Jesus. So the woman starts talking. And she says, they're headed into this little town. She says, I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she bore you, brought you forth. Let me read that again. I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth. As she enters into this whole heading back into town, she's entering into like where her romance happened, where things happened. And so she's starting to think about things and being reminded of things. And, you know, I fell in love with Susan here in this city. Not only did I fall in love with Susan in the city, I fell in love with Susan in E-Free Church, which is up on Swan, this really big church. Our entire relationship from junior high into college, that's where we fell in love. So every time I go to E-Free, I start remembering Susan in her flower dresses and Susan in her long, long hair and Susan and me leading college ministry and Susan and me, you know, out in the parking lot talking for hours and hours and me standing out in the parking lot waiting for her to come out. And I have all of these visuals of our relationship because it all happened in this contained space. And for this girl, she's starting to remember, oh, that's where that happened. That happened under the apple tree. Oh, that, there's a sense of being reminded. And there's a really great theologian. Some of you know this theologian by Overlord Jimmy. Others of you know him as Pastor James. And some of you know him as the worst half of Liz Hildebrandt. But he has some good things to say. Come on, the small group, I'm trying to get you guys to laugh. There's only like one of you who has the same sense of humor I have in this place. So that's not... But anyway, he says, he has this thing, he says that Christianity is mostly a faith of remembrance. And I would say that marriage is mostly a faith of remembrance. That one of the best things that you and I can do in marriage and in relationship with God is remember. And remember. And remember. And remember. Because what happens is we lose track very easily because the tyranny of the moment and of the urgent happens. And we forget why we're in the relationship. And one of the most powerful ways of engaging God and one of the most powerful ways in engaging our wives and our husbands is to remember. Is to spend time sitting and saying, hey, do you remember when we first kissed? Do you remember when I looked at your diary and I wasn't supposed to? Do you remember, y'all, I've been getting so much grief about reading Susan's diary while we were dating. Like, people are appalled that I read her diary. But hey, I figured her out and got married to her. That's how it works. No. But point number one, just to jump out, guys, remembering is important. And one of the last six weeks has been really fun for Sue and I just to sit down after these sermons and remember how our relationship went and how we came together. And one of the reasons that we send people up the mountain, and one of the reasons that we try, I don't know how many of you know this, but we try to send people and say, hey, go off to a monastery, go off to an abbey for a while, is because we want you to stop and spend some time remembering what God has done in your life. Because the best way to understand how Jesus has moved in your life is to look back and say, well, where were you here? Well, where were you here? What were you doing? Why? And to look at how Jesus has moved you in places. But, the other way is good in connecting in your relationship, your married relationship, is to constantly go back and retell the story. Now, one of the things that I would suggest as you have kids is that you retell your romance to your kids. Because what you want is you want your children to be telling their children about your romance. And you want your romance to become mythical to them so that when your grandchildren come along, they're saying, Dad, Grandpa, Grandma, tell me about your romance. Tell me about how it happened. Did you really steal her diary? And it'll become big. And, I've done a lot more with her diary than I ever did. The thing is, it will move you together, but it builds, when you have little children, it builds a place for them to connect to you, to understand how relationship works and all of those things. So, verse 6. And I think you need to understand this, that like re-entry into community once you're married is really awkward. I've watched it in this community because over the last 10 years we've had a lot of young people get married. And what I hear from the married people often, the newly married people, is, I feel like nobody likes me. I feel like no one talks to me anymore. I feel like I don't even know who I am at church anymore. And I hear the single people saying, I don't like this third person in the relationship that I used to have. And there's like this constant trying to figure out what it looks like to be one and how that works in community. And she's entering into that with him. And she's the one who speaks mostly in the Song of Solomon. So this is what she says to him. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, and most vehement flame. Just talking about God's flame there. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the flood drown it. If a man would give for love, if a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. Or some translations say spit on. If you read that bottom section, my conclusion is this woman watches way too many Jane Austen movies. I mean, she's like really into love and what it is, right, as an entity. But the thing that I think two things that are really important here. One is she's entering in back into this, back into their community, back in with their family, and she's saying, you know what, we're going to stop here before we enter in and remind, I'm going to remind you about commitment. I'm going to remind you that we're a team. That we're a team when we go in and do things. And as we interact with our family and our friends, we're a team. Rod, another famous theologian in this church, has some things. He's not here. He's in El Paso preaching. But he has some things to say about marriage. He says that weddings are not about love. Weddings are about contracts. And that weddings are about a commitment that you're making. And they're not a commitment to making, you know, in you know, health and wealth and goodness. They're a commitment to say that when you're grumpy, I'm not leaving. When you're, you know, annoying, I'm not leaving. When you get really depressed for weeks, I'm not going. I'm with you forever. It's saying, it's not about me loving you, because love is actually a contractual thing. It's saying, I agree to do these things, to be here no matter what. And she's saying, like the seal that a king does, you know, when he's going to send out his little, you know, it's just like the seal on your arm. It's also kind of like the idea of a seal that a king, his ring, he puts it in the wax. He sends, like his seal, she's like, put me on your heart. And she reminds him about her love and how love works. It's like death, or it's jealous, it's can't be quenched, God's given it to us. She's given him a pep talk, right? Because, you know, it's kind of scary going back in and being a team. Now let me give you some ideas about teamwork and how it would work. Because point number two is when you make a commitment to someone, you're making a commitment to be on a team. And the way teams work, this is kind of what I see in the picture of the poem. I don't know if you guys watch sports, but really what she's saying is, hey, we're going to see our family. All right, rah, rah, love is like death. Love is like, you know, she's like, okay, rah, rah, let's go. You know, I really see her. She's like, hey, we got to go see mom. Got to see your mom. We're excited. No offense, mom. you always come when I'm talking about moms or dads. So anyway, every week, I guess. You should come every week. I talk about you. teamwork. One of the things that Sue and I do, and we don't have teamwork down perfect, but we are always sitting down, and partly this is our personality, but it's partly a discipline, and assessing things. So we're like, so how is my relationship with Ashton and Elliot? How are you and I doing in our sex life? And we just keep going and assessing. Every Tuesday, our date night, somewhere in that date night, we're kind of talking about where we are spiritually, where we are emotionally, how we're doing with the children, how much we like Keith or not. You know, we're really working on that, because he lives in our house, for those of you who don't know that. We're assessing and like where our relationship is, because we want to be on the same page. We're talking about how we're parenting our kids. We're talking about their education. We're constantly assessing, because it's so easy not to be on the same page. It's so easy to react and not be thinking, okay, well, what would my wife think about this? So one of the most important parts of teamwork is sitting down and assessing. I would also argue that that works in your relationship with Jesus. I think it's one of the most effective ways to walk with Jesus is to have a consistent assessment time where you're saying, okay, Jesus, I'm going to work tomorrow. What do you think about that? There's these kids, and I'm really struggling with this particular one. How do you want me to deal with this? My wife, Lord, what am I to do with her? You know, I think part of our relationship with Jesus is, and being on Jesus' team and understanding where he's at, is constantly asking him, okay, where are we going? What are you doing with this? What are you doing with that? Trying to hear and understand where he's going. Now, I would suggest that you do that with your Bible open, but I also would suggest that you just walk into work and pray that, and you will see Jesus answer things for you. He'll point things out. If you're constantly saying, hey, okay, we're on a team, let's go do this. So, now the family jumps in, the brothers jump in. They've entered into this town, and they say, we have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the days when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Now, we know from the beginning of this that she says her brothers mistreat her. In here, they're saying, basically what they're saying is, we have this young little girl who's been spoken for, and now we have to figure out how to protect her virginity. That's what they're talking about. That's the plain meaning of this. But what I would also suggest, the reason this piece of poetry ends up in this whole dialogue here, is because it's almost what you hear in these brothers is their awkwardness of, now this our little sister is a wife and a woman, and we don't quite know how to relate. And I think that one of the things that those of you who've been married know this, that there's a lot of awkwardness in your family and how to relate to one another once the transition happens of marriage. And so they're just speaking that out. What are we supposed to do with our little sister? And I guess one of the things I'd like to throw in here too is, it's just not the family, it's the friends. And so let me just speak, I wish that there were more of my young married couples here tonight, but let me speak to those of you who are here and those of you who are single and in that relationship. I'll just speak to all of you, but this is how it'll work. I know that these relationships are awkward, and I know that the friendships are difficult. What I would suggest to those of you who are married, who are newly married, is to have some grace. You know, in the drumming circle, we spoke about Jesus' tenderness and compassion. I think one of the callings on young married people is to have tenderness and compassion for their single friends. To see them tenderly and understand that they're not the only, you guys aren't the only ones who've changed. They have to go along with you in that change, and it's really uncomfortable. And so you need to have some tenderness and mercy for them. If you're single and you're in that and you're struggling with that, I would suggest that you be long-suffering, that you realize that these people are trying to figure out their identity, and that you give them some space. If you've been married for a while and you're in this community, I would suggest that you invite these young couples and these single people to your house and hang out with them and let them have some environment to be friends and adjust and help mediate those relationships and be part of it. Help them in those relationships. So, but I would say, I don't have a lot of suggestions for how to deal with your parents. Even if you've been married a long time and still trying to figure out how to deal with your parents. My parents are here, and we're still trying to figure it out, right? I've been married 14 years, and we're still trying to figure out how our relationship works, and we've had wonderful ups and downs and all that good stuff. But what you hear in this passage is sort of this awkwardness of, okay, how do we do this together? And for her, all she has is her brothers, is what it seems like as we follow the poetry along. So, this is what the woman says, verse 10. I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. What is she saying is, I'm a woman. I hung on to my virginity, and my husband has found me pleasant. But it's an interesting statement of her identity to her brothers. She's saying, this is who I am, and my husband is okay with me. So she's putting out her identity. And I think, you know, one of the things, you know, it's kind of awkward, because as I've read the commentators and I've read the translations from here on, they don't know how to translate this. And they're kind of confused as to when the man comes in and when he doesn't. And some of you have the NIV, it tells you, but that's not necessarily true. That's what they thought. What it feels like is a very awkward conversation between family and this new couple. Because in verse 11, a lot of commentators think that the husband jumps in and he says, Solomon has a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased the vineyard to its keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. My own vineyard is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend its fruit, 200. To me, like, I have no idea how this poem is working, but when I read it and I read some of the commentators, it seemed very typical of a man. See, he had his rah-rah experience. His wife says, here we're going into family. Family's like, we're not so sure about you. Woman is saying, I'm a woman. I did it. My husband's happy. And he's like, let me tell you a story. And basically what he just jumps in and starts telling a story that seems like it has nothing to do with anything that anybody's been talking about. He's trying to be a man, and he throws it out. And what he says, basically, this is the funny thing, what he's saying is, Solomon has hundreds of women, and he can have them because my vineyard is before me, right? She calls herself a vineyard earlier in the poetry. My vineyard is before me. I don't need anything else. So that's what he's saying about her, most likely to the family. He just goes off and starts, he took her commitment story and went for it. Now, here's a few things I think are interesting. He calls her a vineyard. Other places he calls her, she refers to herself as a garden. One of the things we haven't talked about in the Song of Solomon a lot, but it is a theme that goes through, is that women are gardens. That's the theme. And they're gardens that not only men tend to, but women tend to themselves, right? She said earlier in chapter 1, she said, you know, my brothers were not very kind to me. I was unable to tend to my own vineyard. I wasn't able to take care of myself because I was out there in the sun, getting sunburned, and I wasn't able to take care of myself. But what he's now affirming is that this is my garden. And I think it's just a thing for husbands. Husbands are gardeners. And I don't know a lot about gardening, but a lot of villagers like to garden. And what I've noticed about villagers' gardens is they all look different. For instance, I was over at Benji and Susan's. And Benji and Susan have this big old net thing that they built, and then they have these gigantic ditches that they put all their plants in the middle, and then they flood them. I was over at Karina's house, and her husband was showing me his entire backyard, which is his garden. And he was explaining this and that. But his garden is very nicely landscaped. And then he's telling me about the silly ground squirrels and how they've dug under his house. And I don't know, did you guys manage to get them yet? Right? But everyone has it, you know, I don't know if you've been to Ryan McCulley's house, but his is very contained and very small and very orderly and very row-oriented, you know, that's Ryan. And everyone has their own way of gardening. For me, like my garden in our front yard, and Keith, our garden is really random. You know, we're like, does that look good there? Yeah, that looks good there. Let's put that there. So then when you get out of the car, you're like trying to step over the flowers and not crush them because we just randomly stuck them in the front of our yard. It looks beautiful. What's that? We had a plan. But so gardening is about being creative. And I would say, guys, that One thing I know about gardening is it takes water. And there are two ways to get water to a garden, you know, in modern time. You bring the hose to the plant and you stand there. Or you get a watering system, right? And you put it on a timer and you hope it works. And you don't forget to set the timer correctly and then everything dies. But you have to water it. And watering takes some form of intention. And I think what I've learned about men by looking at myself and other men is that we are very distractible. Sometimes my wife is like this, Eric, pay attention. Right, what? You didn't hear me. No, I didn't. Because I've gone off into another world. And I think, guys, part of taking care of our wives is choosing to water them, to be intentional about who they are. And one of the things that I'll just give you one example from my life. And I'm not the greatest waterer of my wife, but the one thing that I have tried to be very consistent in is every week I try to get my wife out of the house. I send her with her Bible, I send her with her errands that she wants to run without kids, and because I have little kids, I watch them and I say, get out of the house, go, and spend time reorienting yourself, because it won't be good for all of us. But partly, she needs time to think about herself, tend to herself, and so I need to stop and make sure she has time. And I'm always asking her, do you need time? Do you need to get out of the house? Do you need to go somewhere? Get out. Go. What do you need? So guys, one of the things you can do is just ask your wife, if you're married, hey, what do you need? Go. Get out of the house. If you have kids, I'll watch our children. Whatever it takes. But understand what relaxation, reorientation is for your wife and offer it to her, so that she can have beautiful yellow flowers grow out her ears. Okay? The other thing that's important to understand is that all of us as a church, we're a garden. And one of the things I think was interesting last week that James talked about was our uniqueness. That you and I are very different, right? And that's what makes us beautiful. And one of the things is that Jesus is our gardener. Jesus does tend to us. But one of the things I think as a garden, we're mobile gardens, and we really attempt to replant ourselves in different places all the time. We're always moving, we're always going somewhere. Something I've learned about plants is that if they stay in one place, they're available to be gardened. And I think it's important in your relationship with Jesus to create some time to be watered. Now, one last thing before I close this out. Gardening also means cutting. And I think one of the things, most husbands don't like conflict. We have two ways of operating with people, especially with our wives. We're either really angry and we just roll them over, or we're really passive and we let them control us. But the reason that we get really angry, oddly enough, or we're passive is because we don't like conflict. We don't like to be in any kind of dialogue that's healthy. We just want to push people, we want to push our wife, get her to do what we want her to do. Or we're just like, we won't do anything and we'll let her do what she wants to do. And I would say that part of gardening is pruning your wife. Meaning there are areas in her life that you need to deal with, husbands. And that means that you're going to have to go be uncomfortable and say, hey, hon, we need to talk about it. We need to talk about these things. I would suggest that you do that after you let her go out and spend some time with God and not before. So it closes this way. You who dwell in the gardens, the companions listen for your voice. Let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be like, and the woman says, make haste, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So this is how it all ends. He says, hun, let me hear your voice. And she says, come find me and let's hang out together. That's how this whole poem ends. What time is it? 6:00. Okay. So, this is the end of Song of Solomon. And so a lot of you have heard the whole thing. Some of you haven't. But I have like 10 minutes And I thought, hey, if you really want to ask any question, here's the opportunity. I don't promise any answers. I'll just make James come up here and answer all the questions. But if you want to talk about something, you want to talk about stuff we talked about last week, the week before, want me to clarify things, want more ideas about things, want things to be more clear, throw them at me. Ask me some questions. We have time to ask questions. If you're going to ask me text questions, like why does it say this in the text, I'll try to give you a halfway decent answer, but no guarantees. Any questions? Thoughts? I got plenty of time.
Could you start at the beginning? Because I must have missed the first 5 weeks.
Yeah. All right, I can start at the beginning. It's very, very simple. Woman says, I really, really, really want you. I really, really like you. This is what I like about you. He says, I really, really like you. This is what I like about you. Ooh, let's get married. Marriage is really cool. Then James gets up and talks about, wow, sex is pretty amazing. We're all unique. How are you?
Yes. So just going with the idea of women as guardians, what does that look like?
Who are not married. Well, one of the things I thought that was really interesting in the beginning of Song of Solomon is what the woman says about not having the opportunity to tend her garden. And in an ideal world, in Eric's great philosophy of church, the community should provide space for young single women to grow in their beauty and encourage them to take care of themselves, and that their brothers in the community should not be men who take advantage of them, but give them space to grow and be nurtured. What does that look like? Well, I think for women, it's really helping them be in touch with their relationship with Jesus and what that looks like, and really be passionate about that. I think it means helping them connect to what they think makes them beautiful. To be able to speak out, this is who I am, and this is what's beautiful about me. To be confident in what God has given them, both physically and spiritually and emotionally. It's to build a sense of self. I'm sure people can add to that.
Add to it.
Okay. That was amazing, Lelia. Thank you. That was awesome. Yeah, what Lelia said. She's also a gardener. Yes, it is. Any other questions, thoughts, announcements? Anyone? I'll stand here. Dance. Yeah, no, I would agree. That's good. Samantha? Your husbands need time?
They need
I think it's true. I think what actually Jeff is, you know, it's, he kind of says it jokingly, but yeah, I think men take that. They much more take advantage of that. Right, Ephesians 6. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that Paul's admonishment in Ephesians 6 is that, yeah, you guys take care of your bodies, you should take care of your wife. I mean, it's sort of, I think that's an interesting thought. Anybody else? One thing that I wanted to say, and I think from last week, that was really, really important, and I want to touch on that, is this idea of uniqueness and its importance in pornography, in the context of pornography, because what pornography does, and it does it on both ends for men and women, and one of the interesting things now is that women and their struggle with pornography is becoming such an extent that it's almost equal to men's in our culture now. So it's not just a men's thing. Now, women's pornography is slightly different, but very, very similar. And but what pornography in general does is says that uniqueness is not important. Only one kind of thing is of value, and one kind of shape, and one kind of experience. And what it does is it destroys uniqueness and utterly wipes out the idea of uniqueness, which is what God did when he created humans, was make them unique. And so what pornography does is says no. And it goes against the way God created things. And so I think what James was saying is really a very important thing to fight for as men and women, and that is that we are unique and that who we are cannot be shaped by these images of one kind of human being. And I think what the church has an opportunity to say is not just pornography is bad, because I think that's what our answer has been, is we need to get some groups together, we need to have accountability, and that's important, and we've spoken about the horrible things in culture, but what we haven't been saying is the positive message, which is men and women are very different, we're all very unique, we have very special things to offer, both physically and emotionally and sexually, and we need to speak it out, that what I am is good. And when we go and we look at pornography, what we're saying is that our wife, the women around us, our friends, we're actually attacking their uniqueness. We're saying that's not important. And so what happens is then we get confused as to what beauty is. We get confused about what sexuality is. And I would say, I actually don't have problems in context watching movies with nudity in them, but I'm very, very careful, and I would suggest that you be very careful, that you have a filter on asking yourself, what am I learning about women? What am I learning about men? What am I learning about sexuality? What's being taught to me here? Because I don't think you should be watching other people act out having sex and being naked in front of you because it's entertainment. So if you're going to watch it, it better be for education. It better be for a narrative, not that kind of education. The narrative. an education in the sense of the way that your culture is speaking about men and women. And only that. Because I think it's very dangerous. It's very easy for you to be influenced as to what's beautiful and the way things should be and how sex should be and how relationships should be. And don't think that, oh, I'm strong and I can do it. I'm, you know, no. None of us were meant to sit and watch other people have sex. That wasn't the way God designed things. And so, if you do watch it, I would suggest to be very careful. You can argue with me, but... Hey, I like chick flicks. What are you talking about? I just go. Keep going.
Because, I mean, men are so visual, and you know, so maybe some men actually, you know, like,
Lane, I'm going to end with you, so go for it. And that was good, boy. I'm not going to end with her. I'll go with you. Go for it.
I just sparked Laura when she said, like, one of my pet peeves when I was single was the whole idea of fairy tales. Girls grow up with these very unrealistic expectations of what a guy is supposed to be like. And so, you know, anything like that, pornography, the fairy tales, the chick flicks, whenever they portray something unrealistic to the mass of population B, it distorts people's views of what to expect.
Right. Very good. Oh.
Amen.
Oh. All right. We've got one more. Well, thank you. I think I'm going to pray and then we can have this discussion. We can have a forum afterwards. So let's pray. Dear Jesus, thank you for creating us. Thank you for loving us in the midst of our own rebellion and brokenness. Lord, thank you for just walking alongside of us in our failings and in our victories. And we just ask for your grace as we spend time singing and worshiping you and eating together, that you would just be present with us. We ask that in your name. Amen. There is a couple ways to respond tonight. One is through communion. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took the bread, he broke it, and he said, "This is my body broken for you. Take, eat, in remembrance of me." And at the end of that Passover meal, right before he was going to be betrayed and fled to the cross, he took up the last glass of wine and he said, "This is my blood, the blood of the new covenant. My blood shed for your sins. Take, drink, in remembrance of me." If you can do that, remember this one has wine in it, the other has grape juice, but you can come up, take the bread, break it, dip it in the juice, and remember. Also, if you're just broken by your own sin or other people's sin and you just need someone to pray for you, you can go sit in that chair over there. Someone will pray for you. Lane, would you hand me the offering baskets? No, just the offering baskets. The other way to respond is through offering. You know what I'm going to do, because we're just all spread out, is I'm just going to stick these here. I'll stick one here, stick one over here. And if you have an offering, you can just come up and put that in the basket. We're going to spend some time singing, and then we'll spend some time eating together. And band, you can come up and take communion.